Hello, survivalists. This is the Crux True Survival Stories podcast. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh. In today's episode, we're diving into a fascinating topic, common survival myths, and who better to guide us through this maze of misinformation than my co-host, Julie Henningsen, with so much outdoor knowledge and experience in outdoor wilderness medicine. Julie will be dispelling some of the most dangerous myths related to survival, setting the record straight with facts and expert insights. Whether you're an outdoor enthusiast or just curious about survival tactics, this episode has some good and valuable information that can make all the difference in a critical situation. So stay tuned as we separate fact and fiction and arm you with knowledge you need to survive in the wild. Let's get started.
So myth number one that we'll talk about, if a shark attacks you, you should punch it in the nose. Is that a piece of advice that you've heard before, Casey?
Absolutely. I have heard that before. I mean, I'm rarely in a situation where I'm going to be coming face to face with the shark. So generally, I feel like this one doesn't apply to me at this point in my life, but I have heard that. Yes.
Well, the truth is the nose of a shark is a difficult and pretty small target to hit. So it's better to aim for the eyes and the gills instead. So if you're attacked by a shark, target its eyes and or its gills. That's a more sensitive part and just easier to reach. Like chances, likelihood of success is higher.
It seems like punching, kicking, or hitting any of these parts of a shark underwater would be hard just because it's hard to move rapidly underwater. Like if you tried to ever punch anything underwater, it's like everything is in slow motion because you've got the resistance from the water.
And I also think about like if I'm ever attacked by a shark, my right brain would be so disconnected from my left brain. My thinking brain and my doing brain would be so disconnected. I would not remember where to punch the shark.
Right. Hey, did you hear that story? This was a while ago. And if I can find it, I will bring it back up at some point. But somewhere in Missoula, there was a woman who was being attacked by a bear, or this bear was coming after her. And she took her Nalgene water bottle and just smacked it right over the nose, like whop. And it ran off.
I have not heard that.
That was the end of the encounter.
Nice.
Yeah. So all of us are carrying around these like heavy metal water bottles that can be used as a weapon.
Yeah. Here. Multi-use. Love it. Good
exactly.
Work.
Especially ones with handles, because it's just easier to hold on to.
Okay, myth number two. If you're bit by a snake, a venomous snake, you should suck the venom out of the snake bite. That is a myth. Sucking venom out of a snake bite can actually cause more harm and actually doesn't effectively remove it or cause any benefit. And this is an interesting one. There's actually a lot of myths about what you should do if you're bit by a venomous snake. So again, a little rabbit hole that we can go down. Here in North America, we only have a couple types of venomous snakes. Most snakes are not venomous at all. And a venomous snake, like a rattlesnake is the one that we think about most in Montana. Oftentimes they don't envenomate. There's never any venom injected in the first place because their venom is a really precious resource. And the snake doesn't think it's going to eat you. Like it doesn't want to waste its venom on you. It's just kind of using the bite as a defense technique. So a lot of times they will not envenomate, but you never know if you were envenomated on a snake bite until, you know, hours later. You only know in retrospect. So that means that every time somebody's been bit by a venomous snake and it was a dry bite, like there was never venom injected in the first place, whatever they did to try and treat that bite will seem like it worked. It'll seem like it helped because the bite never progressed. And it wasn't because of what they did. It was because they weren't envenomated in the first place. So you'll hear people say, oh, you should hook it up to a car battery and shock the site of the snake bite, or you should,
oh my gosh,
it open and suck it, do all these crazy things. And those myths get perpetuated because they seem to work in these dry bite situations, which I think are more common than actually injection of venom. And you can even buy, even to this day, you can go into these outdoor stores like REI and in the first aid kit section, you can buy these devices to suck Sawyer extractors to extract venom out of a snake bite, which is just completely myth-based, not helpful, and can do harm. You know, to cut and suck, you're causing further damage to tissue that's already potentially quite damaged. So don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, in that sounds like it's not going to help you regardless. Like, even if you were able to suck some venom, here's the thing. Okay, if you picture the teeth of a snake and then you think about, like, they're almost like needles in some ways. And if you were to inject something with a needle, you're not going to be able to ever suck that out. Mm-hmm. We're already in the bloodstream at that point.
Yeah, it's like getting a tetanus shot and then changing your mind and trying to suck the shot out. It's not going to happen. It's not like it's just sitting in this little reservoir ready to be sucked out.
You might feel better.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah.
You might feel better.
Psychological support there.
Wouldn't you love that if you were with your kids at the doctor's office and you would never get to that point, but like, cut me up and take it out.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
That's hilarious. Well, I think it's interesting that most snakes have dry bites. I knew that was a thing, but it's interesting that they can make that decision based upon whether or not they think that you're worth
eating or you're edible. And this, so I am no expert, which I think might be a herpetologist, but because I'm not one, I could be wrong about that. So disclaimer, but I think the way that snake knows whether or not it's going to be able to eat you is based on like a heat output. Like they can sense you as a heat source. And if you're big enough, you know, they have this gauge where you're something they can eat or something they just need to defend themselves from. And that, you know, the snake level decision making, reptilian decision making comes into play in terms of how much venom and whether or not they inject venom at all when they bite something.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. Another myth related to this, and this one, well, I've already revealed that it's a myth, so I won't ask if it's true or false, but you'll hear it say that baby rattlesnakes are a bite from a baby rattler is more dangerous than an adult. Because they're so little, they haven't mastered this ability to control how much or little venom they include with each bite. So it's more dangerous to get bit by a smaller baby rattlesnake. And that is not true either. At least there's no real evidence to support that claim. So no worries or no more worry than usual if you get bit by a rattler. Most people survive snake bites, you know, the very young, the very old, the immunocompromised that don't do well, but most of us do fine. And what should you do if you get bit by a venomous snake? You should keep the bite area still if you can in terms of avoiding walking and increasing blood flow. You should clean the wound the way you would clean any type of backcountry wound, certainly a bite. And you should seek help, evacuation, rapid evacuation. The cure, the treatment for that is often anti-venom, which is often available at most local, even small hospitals where venomous snakes are known to roam.
Yeah, that's always good to know. I don't think I have any venomous snakes in my neck of Montana, but it doesn't take very far of travel to find an area where you can see rattlesnakes.
Oh, yeah. Yes, snakes abound. Here's another interesting snake bite fact. In the U.S., what the demographic profile of the person most likely to get bit by a snake? What's your guess? Like age range, gender?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. Someone wearing shorts?
Yes, yes. Yeah, the most common place to get bit is the lower leg. That's where the snake bites occur.
Yeah, I would guess probably children, just because they're more likely going off of the path. I don't know. I would guess like somebody that would be like an 8 to 10-year-old boy.
That's a good guess. And it's close. It's not children. And here's why. It's young men ages like 18 to 25, if you broke it down into age groups. Young men age 18 to 25.
Okay.
And the reason it's not kids who are off roaming around playing is if a kid sees a snake, they go the other direction. They're not going to generally mess with it at that age. But when, you know, you get a little older, you get a little more of those kind of testosterone type hormones flowing through the bloodstream. That is like the age group where people are more likely to sort of mess with snakes and be like, hey, check this out. Or, oh, what, you know, let's approach the snake and harass the snake. And, you know, no slight against that chunk of our population, but that's the statistics. So the learning point in that is you are very, very, very unlikely to get bit by a snake, even if you're traveling all over snake country, if you just don't mess with them. See a snake, leave it alone, and it'll leave you alone. It's when you don't leave it alone that you get bit.
Yeah. Okay, that's good to know. Well, we're never going to be in that demographic, so
we're safe.
We're safe.
Okay, next myth. Moss always grows on the north side of trees. And I think it's safe to say that anything that contains the word always or never should be considered unreliable. Moss often does grow on our side of trees, but moss can grow on any side of a tree, depending on the local conditions, depending on the latitude that you're in.
Yeah, I wonder where that myth came from.
Well, I think it comes from humid northern latitudes, like where I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, where there's a ton of moss. And there is more moss on the north side of the tree because it's wet. And if it's not getting daily sunlight, it's going to stay more wet, which perpetuates moss growth. And it's dark because it's not getting daily sun exposure, the same way the south facing part of the tree is. But yeah, it's a statement that is not applicable to all geographic locations and places with differing climates and levels of humidity.
Yeah, right. If you're lost in the woods in Washington, it might come in handy.
It would come in handy. In the wet forests of Washington, it would come in handy. Especially when you're seeing it tree after tree after tree, only one half has moss and the other doesn't, then it's very likely the north side. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to throw a true or false at you, Casey.
Okay.
So this is coming back to our hypothermia, our cold challenge topic.
Oh no. Hot seat. Where you're already an expert and I'm a novice. I see how it is. This is payback.
I think this is valuable. I'm sharing it not to show off my hypothermia knowledge, okay, but because I do think it's like helpful information. Myths are not just like cocktail party talk. You know, it can make a difference if you know the truth versus a myth in terms of your actions in a life-threatening situation. If you make a choice based on a truth that is actually a myth,
right,
it could have a devastating outcome. So true or false, you lose more heat out of your head than you do the rest of your body surface area.
Well, I recall hearing this before, and everyone was saying that that was the case. I don't know if that's necessarily true, just because there's so much more body surface area on the remainder of the body that's not your head. So it just seems like it's false. Logically, it doesn't make sense to me.
Go with logic, Casey.
Okay. My logic says, logically, I'm thinking about Claire Oakley, and she would say false.
Yes. Claire Oakley would be right. Shout out to Claire Oakley, our PA school anatomy and physiology faculty. Yeah, so it is a myth that you lose more body heat. You radiate away more body heat out of your head than the rest of your body. You radiate the same amount of heat. You lose the same amount of body heat from any part of your body, more or less. Certainly not more out of your head. So where does that myth come from? Well, it probably comes from the fact that maybe when we're out in cold environments, we bundle up the rest of our bodies and more of our head surface area is exposed to the elements. If we're not wearing a hat, or even if we are wearing a hat and our face is exposed, it could be that. I don't know where it comes from. I can only speculate. But why is it helpful to know that that's a myth? Because there have been actual stories or tragedies where folks have believed that they would prevent themselves from getting cold or getting hypothermia if they did things like took their pants off in a cold lake and wrapped them around their head to try and prevent heat loss through the head, or done some things to protect their head at the cost of not protecting the rest of their body surface area from heat loss, which is a false logic, and it doesn't promote any better survival and perhaps make survival less of a possibility. So myth busted. And that also comes from Gordon Giesbrecht. I can't take credit for that. I did not do the research behind that one, but he has done it.
Well, thank you, Gordon. Thank you for supplying us with that really helpful information. I think also, like, if you hear some tip ever, you know, you have to think about it logically from this perspective of, okay, are you really going to remove clothing to protect your head? That just doesn't make logical sense. So it's tricky, but I guess that's why you have us, because we can put these little reminders in your back pocket for maybe when you hopefully never need it, or maybe it will just be a good conversation at a cocktail party. Either way.
Either way. It's a win-win.
It's a win-win. So we hope you learned some interesting tips and, you know, remember to choose your airplane seat accordingly this summer and make sure you have some water purification tablets in your first aid kit for this summer.
We're saving you money because the seats in the back of the plane are always cheaper. So you can thank us later for that one.
Yes.
Saving you a few bucks.
Yeah. For our next episode, we're going to be going back in time once again to World War II to discuss a story that will lead you to your faucet to drink a lot of water. I mean, hopefully you guys are open to some of these historical stories. It's just that sometimes we don't really know that these stories exist. If you have any stories that you would like to share or topics that you would like us to discuss or any ideas, please feel free to email us. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of The Crux. Just want to say your support and engagement means the world to us. We truly value the connections we have with our audience. Your stories and feedback and suggestions enrich our discussions and inspire us to bring you more compelling content each week. Please continue to reach out to us. Our email, thecruxsurvival@gmail.com, or on Instagram @thecruxpodcast. I will leave those in the show notes so you can have an easy access to email us. We look forward to sharing more incredible stories and insights with you. So thank you once again for your support and stay safe. You know, make sure you have your prior proper planning in place and keep exploring the world around you. Can't wait to connect with you all again next week.
Thanks, Casey.